done that for a lot longer. So it's quite a high bar to start to talk about rethinking on anything. I would say, I always say that you have to keep an open mind, but not so open that your brain falls out. So, you know, I'm trying to stretch the thinking, but keep it within proper limits. I've also experienced that you find comfort with those who agree with you and growth with those who don't. I usually look for a little bit of a both, and I hope I can offer that for you today as well. There we go. So I'd like to talk about the role of haulage in transforming of mining. And really transforming mining helps us transform haulage as well. But it's really about transforming the world, as we talked about with my introduction as well. That's where I spend most of my time. And I'd like to explain to you why I think we have a good problem here to work on. And why sometimes things get in the way of us actually being able to rethink these things fundamentally as we're going to talk about. And then what tools can we use to overcome that? And then I want to share with you some of the interesting possibilities that exist for us to do that, and what are ideas that I can share with you through my career that has helped companies sort of move this stuff forward. So the good problem to have. Can everybody see the slides properly? Anyway. The transition that we all need to go through is essentially moving from burning stuff to cycling electrons through metals and minerals, right? Even today, everything we have is either grown or is mined. Mining is at the core of society. And as you can see here at the top, these are the things that we have to transition to, and these are the minerals that we need to mine to do that. I think people really don't appreciate the enormous challenge we have in order to transition to an electric mobility environment. And if you look to the right of the slide, from a geopolitical perspective, these strategic minerals that we need is currently centered in places which can cause some geopolitical issues. You know, from an extraction as well as processing, it's the majority is highly concentrated in areas where, given the geopolitics of the world, provides an opportunity for North America to step up, and that's why we call it strategic minerals. Mainly for that reason. I'm going to have to ask for extra time, sorry.
That's okay. I'm counting for it. Okay.
Not sure why it's not working.
New batteries, maybe.
This is not working.
It gives us more time to study the complicated
stuff. Yeah, good. But there should be a limit to that. Okay.
This is one of those breather breaks. Grab another coffee.
Make sure
I mean, if you look at these things, it's quite amazing, right? All the stuff that we need to build, we cannot transition to a renewable economy without these minerals. Where's the minerals going to come from to build the wind turbines, the solar panels? Not just the stuff on the consumption side, like electric vehicles, battery minerals, and stuff like that. It's something that's within our capability to do. And on the next slide, when I get to that, I'll show you sort of what the size of the challenge looks like. There you go. So we can't just step in to this future doing mining the way we did before. And as you see, often when I talk to clients about new technologies and rethinking stuff, the point is always, we'll wait for a greenfield operation to do that. Well, here's the biggest opportunity ever. Just by 2040, we'll have to have 3 billion tons more of metal, 6 times the demand by 2040. And, just for these minerals, it represents something like 400 new mines that needs to be built. That's enormous. The challenge is significant. It takes long time to build these mines, and these mines live for a long time. So the chance for us to make a change is now, if we don't really want to be locked into the old technologies. Mining currently consumes about 10% of the world's energy, and that translates into significant emissions. If you look at non-coal mining emissions, it's probably about 5 to 7% of total emissions. Hauling makes up anywhere from 30 to 80%, depending on what kind of mining operation you have in terms of the energy. And I would suggest to you that it's possible to reduce the energy consumption by about 90%. This is the part where you have to be careful for your brain to fall out. And how do you do that? You can move less stuff, you know, and that you can do in certain mines for sure, and we'll talk a little bit about that, or you can make it significantly more energy efficient when you move stuff, or a combination of that. What we have to aim for is 100% reduction of emissions, which you can also do with today's technology if you can use different fuels, let's say. And then, of course, absolutely, zero issues with health and safety. And I suggest that, of course, the challenge is always, yeah, it's possible, but is it economic? And my view is that it's not just economic, it's actually more profitable for these new technologies and new ways of doing things to accomplish that. And I want to share some of that with you. And the problem, of course, is when you think about that, it's a question of change. We have to change everything we're doing. Change is really, really hard, right? If you think about the stuff that we need to do, absolutely a different mindset that we need to adopt. Somebody like Maynard Keynes said, the challenge we have is not coming up with new ideas, it's to escape from the old ones, right? And our experience becomes our trained intuition over time. And intuition has been shown to be really bad for us sometimes. It sort of fools us into doing things that otherwise, if we slow down and think, we shouldn't do. And I'll give you a quick example of that. There's a person that won the Nobel Prize in economics called Daniel Kahneman that studied biases that people have and how your brain sometimes fools you. And it's really useful just to sort of share some of those insights. And I'll give you one example that you can train, that you can test yourself now. So I'm going to give you a quick math quiz. So if you have a bat and a ball, and the total together cost $1.10, and the ball is $1 more, sorry, the bat is $1 more than the ball, how much is the ball? There's another one. If five machines takes 5 minutes to make 5 widgets, how long does it take for 100 machines to make 100 widgets? Now, if you think 100, and in the previous one, if you thought it's 10 cents, then you're wrong. But it gives you a sense of how quickly our brain sort of jumps to conclusions and fools us with the answers. Now, in MIT, they did this study, very similar questions. They asked for PhD students, about 20 of them. They did this exam. They gave them 20 questions like this. And I think the failure rate was like 80%. 80% of them got questions wrong. And they changed one thing. They actually slowed down the process of you answering the questions by making the text where the questions were written such that it wasn't very clear. So it forced people to slow down and see, oh, okay. And that slowing down of thinking caused their thinking brain to kick in, and most of them got all the questions right. So if you had to go back and slow down and think about these two questions I asked you, you will get the right answers, right? It's 5 minutes and it's 5 cents for the ball. And it's pretty simple. Now imagine for these simple things, how it interferes with your thinking as you actually try to do more complex things. Your intuition sort of gets in the way, right? And there's a study that's been done in the 60s, and it's called the Einstelling effect. It's a notion that when good enough gets in the way of better, right? And I'll give you another example of how they tested that. They took the top chess players in the world, and they gave them a chessboard. And on the chessboard, they gave them they put a set of chess moves in place, where there was a familiar move for 4 moves to checkmate, and an unfamiliar move of three moves to checkmate. They gave these world champions in chess a time pressure to say, find the 3 moves. So these people knew that there was 3 moves to checkmate available. And then they tracked their eyes. After a minute or so, nobody could come up with where the 3 moves were. They saw the 4, they could not see the 3. So what they then did is they took the chessboard away, and they took one piece away of the 4 moves, so that the 4 familiar moves were not possible anymore. And they put the board in front of people again. instantaneously they recognize the three. Is that not amazing? These are the smartest people. So the point of when good enough gets in the way of better is often what we deal with on a daily basis when we have to rethink things, right? Our experience becomes our trap, if you like. And so we need to overcome that. Now there's another story which I'll tell you before I get to more specific Oleg stuff, but it should show you also that sometimes people are able to break through these things. I don't know how many remember Roger Bannister and how he broke the Foreman mile, right? Now, this has been tried since 1886. For 68 years, almost 70 years, people tried to break through this barrier, right? They thought it was really impossible. It became a physiological barrier, not just a physical barrier. They had horses pull people and tried to get them to go faster. And people realized that, you know, the only way to break this, if it's a top athlete with a top coach in front of a home crowd in ideal conditions, that's really the only way this could possibly happen, right? And then came along Roger Bannister, who was a medical student. He didn't have any coach. He trained himself. The day when this race was run was rainy. It wasn't in front of a big home crowd, a couple hundred people. And actually he broke through this. Right? But that's not the most amazing thing. And of course there was nobody there because nobody expected somebody like this to do this. But that was not the most amazing thing. The most amazing thing was that, you know, just a month later, somebody else did that. A year later, three people did that. And 50 years later, 1,000 people could do that. Now, genetics didn't work as fast that people would change or, you know, something physically changed. But it was a psychological barrier that people broke through, right? So sometimes we convince ourselves that things are not possible. And it becomes sort of common knowledge until somebody shows that it is possible. And then suddenly everybody can see it. This is very similar to the chess piece, right? When somebody shows something that's there and it's possible, you know, great things can happen. So I want you to think about that as you think about rethinking the stuff that we need to do for the future. We really need to be able to push boundaries, and we need to do that in a way that allows us to sort of transform the world. And for that, we need tools, right? And this is what I want to discuss with you a little bit. Tools that you need to develop to help you overcome these biases. There's a lot that exists now. And I think it's very exciting that we can use these tools to test these boundaries in a very objective way. So, first of all, there's a couple of dimensions that we always sort of think about when we think about how do we actually change anything. And the first thing is you have to start with why and what it is that you really want, right? And in mining today, it's not just about low cost. It's not just about safety or reliability. It's also now about the environment. It's about society. It's about a lot more. It's about creating more value for more stakeholders and do it in a way that balances those equations, right? So the bar has just been shifted, and it's quite more significant. And then you have to make sure that, you know, to meet that desirable outcome, you need to be able to technically do that, right? And technically not just for the equipment that you're using, but how that equipment is integrated in the full operation. And extending that beyond the operation to understand how that impacts the environment, how that impacts health and safety, how that impacts the business model, how you make money, all of it, right? So we really have to see the system when we think about any of these innovations. Even if it's small innovations, you need to understand the impact on the system. And then lastly, you need to be able to quantify all those elements in a way that understands how that will create cash flows for the company, how that will impact society, and how that will impact the environment. And you need to quantify those in a way that you can objectively understand what those trade-offs are between all those different drivers, right? And that's easy to do with the tools and frameworks that we have now. It's not a question of not having the availability of these tools. It's really expanding the thinking. It's really bringing these tools to bear to sort of objectively evaluate the brutal truths related to that. And then, of course, there's a difference between improving existing systems versus redesigning completely new systems. You know, redesigning the completely new system is often easier because you don't have the constraints of the old system. And sometimes you need to do a hybrid as well, right? So, and if you go back to see all those mines that we need to build, you know, we have a huge opportunity to actually test new things and drive things forward. I think I want to insert this because it's really important. We tend to focus on these innovations, really on the equipment, but really we should not forget the people as well. Since 2012, the World Health Organization classified diesel particulate emissions as carcinogenic. And very recently, I've been involved in some work at Stanford and research to show how bad particulate emissions really can be for humans. If you're in 30 minutes exposed to diesel fumes, you know, you have cognitive impairment, up to 30%. Now, we have to recognize that getting away from diesel is not just an environmental health issue, it's really a people health issue as well, right? And it's really important that we keep that in mind as we tend to go and look at how we can innovate around machines. We also have to keep not just safety, but health, chronic health issues related to people that have to work in these environments. And I'm always very appreciative of what people do on mines when you see the conditions they're working and knowing these things. It's something we have to always keep in mind. Now, I use this framework a lot when I try to understand where the potential lies for any system to improve. And it's helpful because it helps you understand what you need to focus on, and it helps you create language around that. It also helps you understand sort of what is the limits of the potential for the things that we're working on, and that's good. And then it helps us understand what are the things that we need to bring when we think about these improvements to the table to enable that. And I break it down into four layers. The first one is execution waste. And this is really what we're trying to do there is to reduce the variance that we have in your system. It'll be things like driving behavior, right? If a driver drives and accelerates and decelerates, they don't all drive in the same way. And stopping, starting with the huge inertia of these big machines, you know, it could be 50% energy efficiency in some cases that you can gain by just driving more consistently, right? That's what we get when we do autonomous systems. But that narrows the band, hopefully at the top end. And the things that you can use is technology, you can use procedural changes, and then of course behavioral changes and things that you can use to help you with that. Typically you need to measure these things as they happen. These are not things that data analytics will find for you, because they're random variations as part of the system. You cannot see this as statistical significant spikes anywhere in the system. It happens all the time, everywhere. And so you have to be on top of that when you know this is happening to narrow it while it's happening. Then you get the other stuff, which you can look at data post-execution. And you can look at your data over the last, you know, let's say 5 weeks or 5 years, and you see consistently there's an issue in part of the process. You know, the queuing takes too long or something like that. Then you know there's a process change. Then you have to go and make a process change, either using technology, changing the process, changing the way you design the roads, something like that. That usually gives you a bit of a continuous improvement that you always work on. Where can I continually improve when you see these statistically significant wastes occurring in the system? And then you get other stuff, which is structural waste. Now, structural waste is something that is necessary typically in the system. If you have an internal combustion engine, the structural waste is that, you know, the thermodynamics of the engine doesn't allow you to have the level of efficiency that an electric motor will have. That's structural waste in the system, right? And often you have to develop technology to really overcome that by having new technology, replacing components, or changing the system altogether. But that typically gives you quite a big step change, but it's more complicated. And then you get to the design waste part, which is really where the jackpot lies. There's design waste in the whole hauling system design, but go as far as design the mine to fit the hauling system in a different way. That's usually where you get very, very significant changes possible, right? It's very hard if you're stuck in a silo to be able to do that. Now, the higher up you go in this hierarchy, the more you have to expand the people that are involved in the company to be able to help you understand what all those trade-offs and interdependencies are. But the bigger the prize becomes, and it's completely possible. So it becomes almost a people organization issue more than just a technology issue. But when we look at the different technologies, it's colored in different ways. There's another framework I like to use, which, you can't see this very well, sorry, which helps me understand when we talk about technology, we tend to talk about it as this one nebulous term. I'd like to say, well, what kind of technology are you talking about? So we have the mechanical stuff, the structural mechanical mining technology things. These are sort of the weight of the body, you know, torque vectoring maybe in your system, dynamic suspension. These are things that make the mechanical system operate better, right? Then we have on the other side information technology. You know, all the things that we do to make the system act more intelligently. And on the other side we have the energy technology. And there's all the work that you do around renewables, the things that's happening on the energy side, and now you integrate it into one system. And if you look around the room, you can sort of see where people are focusing and what kinds of technologies. And the reason why it's important is because these technologies change at different rates. And when you build a system, you may want to sometimes ensure that in future that you can accommodate some of these new technologies in the system that you're building now. So you're pre-adapting the system to take account of the improvement in these future technologies that you then want to integrate. So make it future relevant. Now, if you just look very quickly at the two, you can't really see this, but at the bottom end here, what we have is our manual era, right? And we're now in a mechanical era. And then you get the automation era, and then you get the network era. And that's sort of the progression through which we're going. But you can see the steepness of that is really on the side of information technology that's helping us drive this forward. And in the beginning of mining, it was really all about organizing people, right? It's people and tools. Now, unfortunately, in places like the Congo, that still very much is what's driving mining. It's people and tools, right? Now, we've mechanized, and so now it's making sure that we're managing maintenance. Now, the machines are doing the work, and we need to make sure that those machines are doing that work optimally. They're optimally utilized. So it's really about people serving those machines, making sure they maintain, making sure they do the work, because they are doing all the work now. And then we're progressing to managing logistics, where people are serving the system. And that's where we get to the autonomous systems. And when we asked the, I think Rio Tinto a long time ago, when they looked at their fully autonomous systems, the CEO said at the time, he said, you know what, we didn't get the financial benefits we thought we would get from autonomous systems, because the cost of building the remote operating centers and stuff, that was quite a lot. But what we got, what we didn't expect, is we were forced to have transparency across the whole logistics of the system. We had to be able to coordinate and see everything. And the value in that was very significant. It was unexpected, but it was very significant, right? So that's where we move into managing logistics, where people now serve the system, not just the tools by itself. And then, of course, when we get to the state where these tools and systems become self-optimizing, then it's really about, you know, managing decisions, and the machines now serve people. And that's sort of the area where we're going to go. And then the last one at the bottom here is where we go from, you know, internal biological systems to external combustion engines to internal combustion engines. Now we're in the renewable area, where we're talking about solar PV and things like that, and battery technologies that's now driving us forward from an energy perspective. And then at the same time, again, you can't see this, I apologize, is as we go now and using information systems to manage energy